3, 2, 1, liftoff.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Welcome to a History of the Space Race podcast. Episode 67, Apollo 11, Part 1. We are finally here, the Apollo 11 moon landing mission. Because there is so much to cover about Apollo 11, I have decided to divide this topic into two episodes. For part one, which is this episode, I will talk about the preparations for the first moon landing, including the astronaut selection process, training for the moon landing, site selection, mission planning, including activities and experiments to be done on the moon, mission control preparations, and preparations for receiving lunar samples and preventing contamination from the moon. Many of these are topics that I wanted to cover before, but were not quite sufficient to make an episode on their own, so I will be covering them here. Part 2, which is the next episode, will discuss the actual mission from liftoff to the moon landing to the return home and the subsequent aftermath. The first thing I want to cover is the selection of the crew for Apollo 11. The crew ultimately selected for the moon landing mission included Commander Neil Armstrong, the Lunar Module Pilot Buzz Aldrin, and the Command Module Pilot Michael Collins. To understand how we ended up with this crew for Apollo 11, however, we must go back in time, all the way to the Mercury program. As I have mentioned much earlier in this podcast, NASA's astronaut corps initially started with just 7 astronauts from the Mercury program. As NASA's manned spaceflight program matured, and it became clear that the Gemini program would require NASA to recruit new classes of astronauts, NASA needed some way to select astronauts for particular missions. The astronauts themselves preferred someone who could fairly assess their performance. In fact, they preferred that one of their own be the selecting official. But identifying an astronaut who would decide who should go on what missions in an unbiased manner seemed impossible. But then NASA got Deke Slayton. Slayton was one of the original Mercury 7 astronauts. As I mentioned in episode 14, Slayton was grounded because doctors found that he had a heart irregularity. No one could prove that the heart irregularity would actually pose a problem for Slayton going into space, but neither could anyone prove that the heart irregularity would not be a problem. In the cautious days of the early manned spaceflight program, that was enough to ground Slayton. This meant, however, that Slayton was now free to take over a new role, the Director of Flight Crew Operations. Essentially, Slayton would choose which astronauts got to go on what missions. His decisions on crew selection were rarely challenged. In fact, Slayton himself only recalled one incident in which his selection was questioned. Otherwise, Slayton was the final arbiter of who went to space and when. During the Gemini program, the astronauts picked up on the fact that Slayton implemented a rotation system. For each mission, Slayton selected 2 astronauts for the prime crew, and 2 more astronauts for a backup crew. The 2 astronauts on the backup crew would become the prime crew for a mission once the mission on which they were serving as a backup was complete. In practice, this meant that a backup crew would become a prime crew 3 missions later. For example, the backup crew for Gemini 4 became the prime crew for Gemini 7. How Slayton selected the crews in the first place remained a mystery to the astronauts. Early in the Gemini program, experience appeared to play a factor. A veteran astronaut would be paired with an astronaut who had not gone to space before. But on other missions, Slayton chose individuals who had no experience in space at all. Nevertheless, the astronauts learned that if they got selected for a backup crew, they were in line for a mission. So they aimed to be on a backup crew. For the Apollo program, Slayton had selected the crews for the various missions in 1966, in anticipation of the first manned Apollo missions. The Apollo 1 fire in January 1967, however, upended all of those plans. It was not until May 1967 that Slayton selected new crews to start training for specific Apollo missions. On November 20th, 1967, Slayton made an important announcement. He disclosed the selections for the Apollo 8 prime and backup crews. The announcement of the backup crew for Apollo 8 was important because, in all likelihood, the backup crew would be the prime crew for Apollo 11. When announced in November 1967, it was by no means certain that Apollo 11 would be the moon landing mission, but in NASA's order of planning for missions, it likely would be. Remember that NASA had laid out 7 Apollo mission types, labeled A, B, C, D, E, F, and G. Apollo 8 was supposed to be a D-type mission, a test of both the command and lunar modules in Earth orbit. If all things went well, Apollo 9 would be the E-type mission, which was a high-altitude flight. Apollo 10 would be the F-type mission, a full dress rehearsal. Apollo 11, 3 missions later, would be the G-type mission, the landing on the moon. As discussed in the episode on Apollo 8, NASA's planning did not quite go exactly as planned. Because the lunar module was not ready, Apollo 8 became a high-altitude flight all the way to the moon with only a command module, making it more like an E-type mission originally intended for Apollo 9. Due to the slight change in sequence, there was no guarantee Apollo 11 would be the moon landing mission. But in all probability, it would be. And that meant that the backup crew for Apollo 8 would likely be given the moon landing mission. The Apollo 8 backup crew, announced in November 1967, consisted of Commander Neil Armstrong, Lunar Module Pilot Buzz Aldrin, and Command Module Pilot James Lovell. Many histories of Apollo 11 insist that Slayton selected the crew for the moon landing mission blindly and did not intentionally select specific astronauts for the first moon landing. But given Slayton's knowledge of how the mission sequence was likely to pan out, this is rather hard to believe. He could not guarantee Apollo 11 would be the moon landing mission, but he knew there was a pretty good chance. And he could not have completely disregarded that fact when selecting the backup crew for Apollo 8, which he knew would be rotated in to become the prime crew for Apollo 11. We also know for a fact that Slayton tried to break his rigid rotation system to select specific astronauts for Apollo 11 after the fact. You see, there was a change in the Apollo 8 backup crew. Michael Collins was originally on the prime crew for Apollo 8 as the command module pilot. But Collins had to undergo surgery and was removed from the prime crew. James Lovell, the command module pilot on the backup crew, then moved into the prime crew. After recovering from surgery, Collins joined Armstrong and Aldrin as part of the backup crew. This became the final crew composition that actually performed the Apollo 11 mission. Slayton, however, had given Armstrong the opportunity to change his crew. Specifically, he offered to replace Buzz Aldrin, the lunar module pilot. Slayton made the offer because Aldrin apparently had a reputation for being difficult to work with. Aldrin had also generated some controversy about who should set foot on the moon first. If Apollo 11 were the mission to land on the moon as planned, he as the lunar module pilot and Armstrong as the mission commander would be going to the surface of the moon in the lunar module, leaving Mike Collins in orbit in the command module alone. As the lunar module pilot, Aldrin believed that he should be the one to step out onto the lunar surface first. The precedent for his position came from the Gemini program, where the commander of the mission did not perform EVAs. Instead, it was the co-pilot who exited the spacecraft for the EVAs, and the commander stayed inside the spacecraft. Many individuals assumed, just like Aldrin, that the commander, that is Neil Armstrong, would not step onto the moon first. This included the director of the Office of Manned Spaceflight, George Miller. When rumors circulated that there might be a change from past practice and that the commander, Armstrong, would be the first to step out on the moon, Aldrin tried to gather support from other lunar module pilots for the position that the lunar module pilot should be the first one to step out of the spacecraft. This kind of lobbying did not play well in NASA's atmosphere of impartiality and equality, and maybe one reason why Slayton gave Armstrong the chance to replace Aldrin. Armstrong thought the matter over and turned it down. Armstrong said he personally did not have any problem working with Buzz Aldrin. In addition, the proposed replacement for Aldrin was James Lovell, and Armstrong wanted Lovell to have a chance to command his own mission, a chance that would at the very least be delayed if Lovell joined the Apollo 11 crew as the lunar module pilot. The whole incident shows, however, that Slayton was not blind when choosing the crew that would land on the moon first. On the contrary, he was quite conscious about choosing who would go. With the Apollo 11 crew selected, the next matter that had to be turned to was training. Training for the portions of the mission involving the command module were not a problem. A simulator had already been in place for the previous missions. The problem here was building a simulator for the lunar module. Development of the lunar module simulator naturally lagged behind development of the lunar module itself. An accurate simulator could not be constructed until the performance characteristics of the spacecraft were known, and the performance characteristics could not really be known until the lunar module was actually flown in space. That was not done in a manned mission until Apollo 9 in March 1969. Prior to that, NASA did develop two simulators to help the Apollo 11 crew train for the lunar landing. The first was the Lunar Landing Research Facility, located in Langley, Virginia. At this facility, a lunar module was suspended from a giant crane bridge. The cables connecting the lunar module to the bridge crane neutralized 5/6 of the spacecraft's weight, effectively simulating the 1/6 gravity of the moon. This facility, however, had its limitations, as the spacecraft in the simulator could only move in 4 directions: up or down, and left or right. The second simulator was known as the Lunar Landing Research Vehicle, or the LLRV. This was one crazy vehicle, as revealed by its nickname, the Flying Bedstead. The LLRV was basically a jet engine attached to an aluminum frame arranged in trusses with an open box that served as a pilot seat. The jet engine on the LLRV was pointed to the ground to displace about 5/6 of the vehicle's weight, once again simulating the moon's 1/6 gravity. Meanwhile, small rockets provided attitude control and upward and downward movement. The pilot seat on this vehicle was an ejection seat capable of accelerating the pilot into the sky up to an altitude high enough for a parachute to deploy. The ejection seat was unusual because it was capable of saving the pilot's life even when fired on the ground, which was necessary because the LLRV was never meant to fly very high. The LLRV was known as a skittish vehicle and has been described as a helicopter flown with a jet engine rather than rotors. It was extremely difficult to control. In fact, the Apple TV Plus show For All Mankind illustrates the danger of the LLRV when an accident kills one of the characters on that show. This fictional accident was actually a nod to a real historic event. On May 6, 1968, Neil Armstrong ejected from an LLRV during training after the attitude control thrusters ran out of fuel. Armstrong survived the crash unhurt. Just to note though, Armstrong was the one training in the LLRV, even though Buzz Aldrin was the lunar module pilot. This is because the commander of the mission always took manual control of the lunar module just before landing. The lunar module pilot was just responsible for getting the craft from lunar orbit to near the surface. After Armstrong's ejection from the LLRV, all further training with the vehicle stopped. It was only at Armstrong's insistence that he needed this training that flights were resumed in the spring of 1969. An improved version of the LLRV, known as the Lunar Landing Training Vehicle, or LLTV, was eventually available for the astronauts to use. But the improved LLTV was not available until June 1969, a little over a month before the Apollo 11 mission. Armstrong was nevertheless able to take advantage of the LLTV and trained in it right before the launch of Apollo 11. Just as important as training for the lunar landing mission was knowing where to land. In 1966, NASA established a site selection board to identify potential landing sites for the Apollo missions. The board used photographs initially gathered from the Ranger program, and then photos from the Lunar Orbiter program and data from the Lunar Surveyor program to identify potential landing sites. The Site Selection Board pored over the photos and data taken from these programs with three main factors in mind. First, they wanted a landing site near the equator to minimize the use of fuel for landing and rendezvous after the mission. Second, they wanted a site that was clear of obstacles to avoid collisions and use of fuel near the landing to avoid obstacles. Third, the board wanted a relatively flat area to simplify radar acquisition for the lunar module's radar. Scientific value was not a factor, at least not for the first landing. In addition to these general considerations, there were also two other must-have conditions that severely restricted potential landing sites for Apollo 11. First, Apollo 11 must reach the moon on a free return trajectory. This meant that if the service module engine failed to fire sometime during the journey to the moon, Apollo 11 would simply boomerang around the moon and come home. Remember that the service module engine was the only engine available to the astronauts for significant maneuvers after separation from the final stage of the Saturn V. If it did not work, the astronauts may not be able to get home. This was why NASA, in its conservatism, at least in the planning for the early Apollo landing missions, insisted on a free return trajectory in the event that the service module engine failed. The free return trajectory requirement, however, meant that the flight path for Apollo 11 had to stay pretty close to the moon's equator. This in turn limited potential landing sites to only about 5 degrees of latitude of the lunar equator. The second must-have requirement was lighting during the EVA on the surface of the moon. If the sun was not shining on the landing site during the mission, the astronauts would not be able to see anything. On the other hand, if the light was directly above them, the sun would simply wash out all the features on the moon's surface, and the astronauts wouldn't be able to see anything either. For Apollo 11, the Site Selection Board wanted the sun to be shining on the landing site at a particular range of angles. The desire was for the sun to generate shadows that the astronauts could use to identify features and hazards on the lunar surface when trying to land. The sun could not be too low, because then the shadows generated would be far too long, and that would confuse the astronauts. Considering the angle of the sun, the Site Selection Board concluded that a landing could occur at any particular site only during a 2-day window. This in turn meant that the launches from Earth had to occur on time to make it to the moon while the 2-day window was still open. But the launch date could easily be delayed by more than 2 days for a variety of reasons, such as bad weather. To solve the problem of the launch window, the Site Selection Board decided to select a primary landing site on the eastern side of the moon. If the launch had to be delayed, then backup sites towards the western side of the moon could be chosen, since a site slightly to the west would get the proper angle from the sun a few days after a site selected in the east. On February 8, 1968, the Site Selection Board announced 5 potential landing sites for the first moon landing. The first 5 sites were labeled 1 through 5, with the most eastern site being given the number 1, and the most western site being given the number 5. Sites 1 and 2 were in the Sea of Tranquility, towards the eastern side of the moon. Site 3 was in Middle Bay, right in the middle of the moon. Sites 4 and 5 were in the Ocean of Storms, on the western side of the moon. For Apollo 11, the primary moon landing site was Site 2 in the Sea of Tranquility. Indeed, during the Apollo 10 mission in May 1969, the lunar module Snoopy flew right over Site 2 to gain more information for Apollo 11. If for some reason the launch of Apollo 11 was delayed, Site 3 in Middle Bay was to be the first backup landing site. Site 5 in the Ocean of Storms was to be the second backup site. So now we have the crew selected, training available, and the landing site selected. Another key preparation for the Apollo 11 mission was selection of the mission control team. During episode 34 on Gemini 4, I talked about how the proliferation of multi-day manned missions to space necessitated an increase in mission control teams. These teams, each under a different flight director, would provide 24-hour coverage for a manned spacecraft mission in 8-hour shifts. In the early days of Gemini, there were only 3 teams, labeled by color, red, white, and blue. By the time we get to Apollo, the number of teams have increased, as well as the varying use of colors. For each mission, there would be a lead flight director who was overall responsible for the mission. The lead flight director would then choose 2 other flight directors to fill out the 24-hour coverage. For Apollo 11, the lead flight director was Cliff Charlesworth. As lead flight director, Charlesworth got to choose the other 2 flight directors for this historic mission. On top of that, he would choose who served in which rotation, meaning he could decide which flight director would be in charge during the moon landing. Charlesworth chose not himself for this most historic part of the most historic mission to space, but rather flight director Eugene Krantz. This decision was quite emblematic of NASA culture in this era. Assignments were made by ability and merit. Nothing more, nothing less. And Krantz's white team certainly had the ability and the merit. Krantz's mission control team had worked on Apollo 5 during the unmanned test of the lunar module in Earth orbit. They had also worked on Apollo 9 during manned maneuvers with the lunar module. There was no better team positioned to direct the lunar module during the first moon landing. Just like the astronauts, the mission control team needed to train for the lunar landing. During the trainings, the astronauts would be inside a simulator, and the mission control team would receive data from the simulator just like a real mission. This simulation allowed everyone to get used to conditions that would exist during the actual mission. Most importantly, the astronauts in mission control had to get used to the transmission delay between the moon and Earth. A radio signal takes about 1.3 seconds to reach the Earth from the Moon. So for mission control to hear the astronauts or receive data from the spacecraft and issue instructions back to the Moon, there would be a delay of about 2.6 seconds. On top of this transmission delay, the mission control team had to deal with delays receiving telemetry from the spacecraft. The computers of the era took about 4 to 5 seconds to process the information from the spacecraft radar and then send that data back to Earth. So in total, there would be about a 7 or 8 second delay before Mission Control knew what was going on with the lunar module. The simulations became increasingly difficult when the human simulators, that is the human testers running the simulation, introduced errors to see how the astronauts in Mission Control would react. The errors could be simple, such as an error on the display panel. They could also be complicated and multifaceted, such as thrusters being stuck open. The initial simulations, however, had no real problems, so the astronauts in Krantz's mission control team got used to what a nominal landing mission would look like. Then the testers started introducing those errors. At once, the astronauts started crashing, or the mission control team ordered aborts where there was no abort needed. Both results were bad. With practice, however, Krantz's white team grew increasingly confident. By July 5, 1969, only 11 days before launch, they were successfully guiding the astronauts to a safe landing without any unnecessary aborts. One of the very last simulations, however, shook Krantz's team. As the simulations started to come to an end, they decided to bring in the crew of Apollo 12 instead of the crew of Apollo 11. The idea was that the mission control team should get more training by helping a crew who had less experience. Since the set of simulations was coming near the end, the humans setting up the tests usually made the simulations easier. The idea was to build the team's confidence before a mission, not shatter it. But during the penultimate simulation, the testers shocked Eugene Krantz's white team. When the simulated lunar module was only about 10,000 feet above the moon's surface, the computer started blaring alarms that it was overloaded. In accordance with information available to him at the time, the guidance officer, Steve Bales, called for the mission to be aborted. Now, we need to back up a little here to provide a little bit more context for these computer alarms. Computer alarms are mainly for software engineers. They tell software engineers when something is wrong, and they do not do so with any particular accuracy. In general, these computer alarms just come back as a number. The error number identifies the problem, but not necessarily the source of the problem. Take, for example, the very common and dreaded 404 error code. If you have ever used the internet, which these days everyone has, at some point you have encountered the 404 error code. This means that the file or web page you are trying to reach cannot be found. But there are many reasons why the file or web page cannot be found. You may have introduced a keystroke error and typed in the address wrong. The server containing the file or the web page may be temporarily down. There could also be a temporary disruption of your internet connection. The point is, the 404 error code is a stand-in for a host of potential problems. In 1969, with computers being far less ubiquitous than they are today, the average person had never heard of these types of software error codes. Really, there was no reason for anyone outside the field of software engineering to know anything about them, since the error codes were really for the software engineers. The testers running the simulations for the mission control team only learned about the software error codes themselves by happenstance. One member of the simulation team, Jack Garman, was a computer specialist, and in a passing conversation, he happened to mention these computer error codes. Garman had not mentioned them before because, again, the main purpose of the error codes was for the software engineers to debug problems. He did not think that the error codes would actually appear during a mission. But because the error codes were related to the computer displays used by the astronauts, an error code during the mission could produce flashing lights and an audible alarm. So the simulators put them into a test. After Eugene Krantz's team called an abort due to the simulated computer error, the mission control team realized that they had no mission rules for what to do with computer alarms. By the end of the day, Krantz ordered his team to find every single possible computer alarm code and learn how they should respond to every single one of them. They were only days away from the launch of Apollo 11. I will flag now that there will be a lot more to say about these computer alarms during the Apollo 11 mission, and how members of Krantz's team will save the moon landing mission because of this preparatory work. But I will save that discussion for part 2 when I talk about the actual mission. Before we get to part 2, however, I also want to cover mission planning for Apollo 11. Early plans for the lunar surface mission were quite conservative. NASA planned for the Apollo 11 lunar module to stay on the moon's surface for only about 20 hours. The EVA on the moon would be limited to only about 2.5 hours. And at one point, it was even suggested that only one of the two astronauts should exit the lunar module. The idea was that Apollo 11, as the first moon landing mission, was really just an engineering confirmation mission. That is, they were simply proving that a human could land on the moon and return home. Anything on top of this, such as collection of lunar samples and deploying experiments, was extra and unnecessary to the core mission. Here, we once again see that age-old battle between engineering and science, a concept I introduced way back in the early days of the Ranger program. If you'll recall, some of the blame for the early failures of the Ranger probes was put on the fact that the engineers had tried to accommodate scientific experiments on the probes at the cost of weight and space that could have been used to create redundant systems to ensure that the spacecraft worked. Over time, the engineering side of NASA's space program definitely won. Scientists were often forced to remove their experiments from unmanned probes. And when the Gemini program came along, the focus was once again on engineering and learning piloting techniques for the astronauts, not science. To get NASA's Office of Space Science to acquiesce to the limited role of science, the scientists had often been promised that the Apollo program and the moon landing would make up for the lack of science earlier in manned spaceflight programs. So, when the Office of Space Science heard rumors that there would be no scientific experiments on Apollo 11, they pushed back hard, fearing that science would once again be kicked out, this time out of the Apollo program entirely. In the end, NASA's Office of Manned Spaceflight made some concessions to place a few basic experiments on the moon during Apollo 11. There were three experiments in particular. The first was a reflector panel. This panel required no power and just needed to be placed in a level position on the moon. Once set up, lasers would be shot at the reflector panel from Earth to measure the distance between the Earth and the moon, among other things. The second experiment was a solar-powered seismograph to detect moonquakes. The third experiment was a solar wind composition experiment. All that this required was putting up a small sheet of aluminum foil, which would then be exposed to solar wind. All of these experiments were acceptable for the first mission to the moon because none of them required much time for the astronauts to set up. The main scientific area of investigation for Apollo 11, however, was geology. The major goal was, after all, to collect moon rocks and moon soil and bring them back to Earth. To assist in this, the astronauts going to the moon were all given a basic college-level class in geology. They were then sent out into the field on Earth to identify interesting geological features, and were then graded on their ability to identify interesting features. Some astronauts picked up on geology faster than others, but none of the astronauts were going to ever be expert geologists. As Apollo 11 grew near, Armstrong actually worried he was not sufficiently familiar with geology. His last lesson before launch had been provided in April 1969. He worried that he might miss something important when he got to the moon. But the geology experts told him not to worry. Whatever he brought back would be interesting, simply because he would be the first to bring moon rocks back to Earth. As we enter 1969, mission planning for Apollo 11 began to focus more and more on the ceremonial aspects of the mission. In January 1969, NASA began to host internal discussions about how to commemorate the first manned landing on the moon. Early discussions suggested planting the flag of the United States on the moon's surface, along with the flag of the United Nations, to demonstrate that the mission had been carried out for all humankind. The descent stage of the lunar module would also carry the flags of all UN member states. NASA eventually formed a committee to decide what to do. Deke Slayton took the position that the committee could ask for whatever it wanted, so long as they did not require the Apollo 11 crew to undergo further training. 2 weeks before launch, on July 2, 1969, the committee made its decision. Only the flag of the United States would be unfurled on the moon's surface. The idea was that the American people, who paid for the entire endeavor after all, needed to know that this was an American moon landing. The descent stage of the lunar module, which would be left behind on the lunar surface, would carry small flags of all UN member states. In addition, the descent stage would carry micro-miniaturized photograph prints of goodwill letters from all nations. The astronauts would also unveil a plaque attached to the descent stage commemorating the mission. With all this discussion about planting the American flag, however, there were concerns that Apollo 11 might be seen as an American claim of territorial sovereignty on the moon. Such a claim would have been an explicit violation of the Outer Space Treaty of 1967. To avoid breaching this treaty, the General Counsel of NASA, Paul Dembling, advised Neil Armstrong not to say anything along the lines of claiming the moon for the United States. At the same time, NASA's Public Affairs Office prepared a statement reaffirming the Outer Space Treaty and disclaiming any assertion of sovereignty over the moon. The last ceremonial issue that had to be addressed was the name of the spacecraft. As I've mentioned before, the lunar module and the command module each needed a different call sign. When they were both operating separately near the moon, they could not both be called Apollo 11. As in the past, the call signs were made up by the crew. And all the way into early 1969, the crew of Apollo 11 referred to the command module as Snow Cone, presumably because the shape of the spacecraft looked like a snow cone. They also referred to the lunar module as Haystack, also presumably because of the shape of the spacecraft. Julian Scheer, the public affairs officer from NASA headquarters, intervened and told the astronauts not to be so flippant about naming their spacecraft. I can imagine Scheer telling the astronauts to think about the history book saying the haystack has landed. So, taking the matter a bit more seriously now, the crew decided to name the lunar module Eagle, because the mission patch that Mike Collins designed for Apollo 11 depicted an eagle, a symbol for the United States landing on the moon. The command module was named Columbia. The origin of the command module's name is a little bit vague. Depending on your source, the reason for naming the command module Columbia could be one or more of the following three reasons. First, Columbia could be a reference to the name of the cannon in Jules Verne's novel, From the Earth to the Moon, which fired humans up to the moon. Second, Columbia could be a reference to the Americas. And third, Columbia could be a reference to Christopher Columbus. What every source I have seen seems to agree on is that the astronauts did not come up with the name Columbia. Instead, it was Julian Scheer, the public affairs officer, who suggested it, and the astronauts simply agreed. So, to really know why the command module was named Columbia, one would have to ask Julian Scheer why he suggested that name. As far as I can tell, however, journalists and historians only bothered to ask the astronauts why the command module was named Columbia, and not Julian Scheer. This has led to the number of post hoc rationales for the name. The final topic I want to cover before getting to the actual Apollo 11 mission was NASA's preparations to receive lunar samples and the astronauts after they returned from the moon. Back contamination was a major concern ever since the advent of satellites, and that concern expanded with the start of manned spaceflight. In fact, going all the way back to episode 1, you might recall that the International Council of Scientific Unions, which was the organizer of the International Geophysical Year, had encouraged the launch of the first satellites. Well, shortly after the launch of the first satellites, the International Council of Scientific Unions established a committee to discuss preparations that should be taken to prevent contamination of Earth by organisms that might be from other planets. This, in turn, jump-started some of the first discussions on the international law of outer space. A big problem, however, was that these concerns about back contamination were mainly held by scientists. Engineers tended to ignore this problem or think it was not a serious concern. This was a problem for NASA because, as I mentioned earlier, the engineers in NASA, and particularly the engineers in the Office of Manned Spaceflight, had basically seized dominance in NASA's space program to prioritize engineering concerns over scientific ones. This meant that those planning manned missions, like the Apollo program, often considered the problem of back contamination only as an afterthought. NASA's Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston, which was responsible for overseeing much of Apollo, was not entirely blind to the problem of back contamination, but it was the last major problem that they turned to. In 1964, well after all the programs for building the lunar module, the command module, the Saturn V, the launch facilities, the communications, and just about everything else had started, the Manned Spacecraft Center finally started giving serious consideration as to how they should be receiving any lunar samples collected from the moon. The first plans that the Manned Spacecraft Center came up with were ridiculously inadequate. The first plan called for a 100-square-foot lab that would just hold the lunar samples in a near vacuum. The lab was tiny since the thinking was that the lab would just be a temporary holding facility where the samples were distributed to other scientific installations. The vacuum was there to prevent any contamination and to preserve scientific value. It was not long before the initial plan was thrown out due to a fundamental misunderstanding about the needs of the lab to receive lunar samples and how it would operate. For example, the initial planners, read engineers, had envisioned a facility that would only be used temporarily after the return of an Apollo mission, before the lunar samples were further distributed. But when the expert, read the scientists, opined on the matter, they pointed out that you can't simply have a facility that turned on and off as samples were processed. For practical reasons, once the near vacuum of the lab was established, it needed to stay a near vacuum. Repressurizing it and then depressurizing it repeatedly created maintenance problems and difficulties ensuring that the room was actually sterile. As more thought was put into the planning, they also realized that a quarantine facility would be needed for the astronauts, not just the lunar samples. By the end of 1965, NASA's plans for what would become known as the Lunar Receiving Laboratory, or LRL, expanded considerably to an 8,000-square-foot facility that would cost $6.5 million. The cost of this facility, keep in mind this is 1965 dollars, came at a terrible time. NASA's budget was peaking in 1965 as Congress became more and more critical of the moon landing endeavor. This multi-million dollar expense, coming right when NASA had promised that the cost of the Apollo program should start winding down, only drew skepticism from Congress about how well NASA was managing its budget. The problem could have been avoided altogether had NASA given more serious consideration to back contamination and included this facility in its earlier funding requests, along with Launch Complex 39 and the host of other facilities NASA needed for the Apollo program. But as I said, NASA's engineers had largely won the fight for control over the Apollo program, and it was the scientists that were the main representatives of the concern about back contamination. NASA's management at first tried to reduce the funding request by seeing if some existing facility could serve as the lunar receiving lab. There was none. The most qualified facility was in Fort Detrick in Maryland. Fort Detrick housed facilities for chemicals weapons development, but even those facilities were not sufficient for NASA's needs. Not to mention that NASA would have had to disrupt the military's chemical weapons program at that time in order to use Fort Detrick. In 1966, when NASA asked Congress for funding to build a new lunar receiving lab in Houston as part of the Manned Spacecraft Center, they were shot down. Congressmen from the House Appropriations Committee viewed the laboratory as simply a ploy to get more money from Congress in the future for an expanded Apollo program. One of these was then-Congressman Donald Rumsfeld, future Secretary of Defense under President George W. Bush. It did not help that NASA gave no explanation for why the Lunar Receiving Laboratory should be located in Houston, Texas, the president's home state. Making matters worse, an untimely death of one congressman meant that NASA had lost a major supporter on the Appropriations Committee. NASA sheepishly had to go back to the House Appropriations Committee and explain why the Lunar Receiving Laboratory was so important. They also finally explained that the lab would be placed in the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston because it was the engineers at the Manned Spacecraft Center that would need to debrief with the astronauts in quarantine after the mission. The same people would also need to examine the command module, which also needed to be placed in a quarantine facility. The House Appropriations Committee relented and approved $9.1 million for design and construction, though this number was subsequently cut down as the bill passed through the rest of Congress. Construction on the Lunar Receiving Laboratory was complete by around mid-1967. But there was still a lot of work to be done to prepare for the first mission coming back from the moon. Procedures had to be established to properly receive the lunar samples, the astronauts, the command module, and to maintain their quarantine and prevent back contamination from the time the spacecraft splashed down in the Pacific Ocean all the way to the Lunar Receiving Laboratory in Houston, thousands of miles away. To develop the procedures to prevent back contamination during transport, NASA coordinated with other federal agencies to establish the Interagency Committee on Back Contamination, or the ICBC. The ICBC included representatives from NASA's Manned Spacecraft Center, the National Academy of Sciences, the Department of Agriculture, the Department of Interior, and the Public Health Service. The ICBC was given the authority to order the delay of the Apollo 11 mission if NASA did not develop sufficiently acceptable procedures to prevent back contamination. Note that most of the agencies and representatives in the ICBC were scientists. They had little participation in the day-to-day planning of the Apollo missions, which was left up mostly to the engineers at the Manned Spacecraft Center. By 1968, the ICBC grew incredibly concerned that NASA was not taking the problem of back contamination seriously. The ICBC laid out a series of procedures that NASA should adopt to prevent contamination during the transport of the Apollo 11 command module and the astronauts from the Pacific Ocean to Houston. These procedures included hoisting the command module from the ocean directly onto the recovery ship with the astronauts inside, without opening the command module door, and filtering the air inside the command module before opening the door. When NASA's Manned Spacecraft Center received these concerns, they moved to address the problem. NASA rejected the idea of hoisting the command module onto the recovery ship. They were concerned that the loop at the top of the command module would slip, and the spacecraft, and astronauts inside, could fall back into the water, causing serious damage and injury. NASA did, however, come up with a series of other compromises and measures to prevent back contamination. The plan was that when the two astronauts in the lunar module returned from the surface of the moon and docked with the command module in lunar orbit, they would take measures to prevent contamination in the lunar module from spreading into the command module. First, they would release more oxygen into the command module and vent more air from the lunar module, creating a flow in the air that went from the command module to the lunar module. This would reduce the amount of lunar dust entering the command module. Second, the astronauts would bag their pressure suits that they wore on the moon before bringing them into the command module. NASA also showed that during the 63-hour journey from the moon back home, the command module's existing environmental control system would filter out any organisms that may have been transferred into the command module's atmosphere. As a result, by the time the command module splashed down in the Pacific Ocean, the cabin door could be opened into the Earth air. The only potential source of contamination would be the astronauts themselves. To control contamination from the astronauts after splashdown, the astronauts would exit the command module onto a raft. They and the initial recovery team would then be rubbed down with an iodine solution. The astronauts would then don biological isolation garments. From there, the astronauts would be lifted by helicopter to a recovery ship, where they would then enter a mobile isolation unit. The ICBC was generally satisfied with the procedures that NASA developed in response to their concern. The ICBC continued to express concern about procedures to be followed if the command module had to splash down in another area and was picked up by a backup recovery ship, which might not be as equipped for quarantine measures as the primary recovery vessel. But this concern was not enough for the ICBC to hold back the Apollo 11 mission. On June 4, 1969, a little over a month before launch, a special task group formed that stood ready to direct quarantine operations from recovery all the way to the Lunar Receiving Laboratory. So I have now covered all the preparatory items that I wanted to cover before the Apollo 11 mission. In part 2, we will start with liftoff on July 16th, 1969 at 9:32 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time.